Tom. Thank you, Peter. Thank you for the invitation. I hope everybody can see the slides and can hear me okay. And thank you very much to Ruth for agreeing to be the discussant. So I wanted to address the theme of the capability approach and its implications for labour law. How would a capability approach perspective change the way that we might think about social and labour rights? And I want to revisit the analysis in Chapter 5 of the book I wrote with Frank Wilkinson in 2005, The Law of the Labour Market, which sets out some possible readings of the capability approach in the context of a historical analysis of the law relating to the labour market, labour law and social security law in Britain from the period of the Industrial Revolution up more or less up until the present day. So it's an attempt to revisit work that Frank and I did and to put that work in the context of certain ideas about how labour law might create opportunities which can be interpreted as capabilities. Because we understood law to be an institution which in sense terminology might be a conversion factor which would enable the creation of capabilities and the conversion of capabilities into functionings, broadly understood. So that was how we presented capabilities in 2005, but it was part of a larger attempt to seek to understand how the labour market, specifically in Britain, but the argument has a wider application, had come into being as part of a process of institutional change, which was reflected in law. So I also want to talk a little bit today about methodology and the method we employed in the book and why that might be of interest to lawyers and to social scientists more widely. Then I want to come up to date to talk about the current Employment Rights Act or bill, which has just been published in the UK and is clearly an important moment for labour lawyers and hopefully for social scientists as well, other social scientists, because it's the first time in a generation really that there's been this opportunity to discuss a meaningful piece of labour law reform in the UK. It really has been almost 30 years since there's been a similar opportunity. It last arose in the late 1990s. And I'm old enough to remember that time. Okay, so we can talk a little bit about that as well. So what was our approach in the law of the labour market? We wanted to explore ways in which legal thought and legal practice institutes a commodity that we know from Marx as labour power. So as Marx very clearly says in Capital and elsewhere, there's really nothing natural about the commodity labour power. It had to come into existence through human agency and through particular material changes and also through ideological ones. And law's especially interesting. Marx didn't write a lot about law, but he did write something about it. But law's very interesting, I think, because it's a space within which one can explore how ideas evolve, concepts, but also those concepts that lawyers use, like contract or status for that matter, have a clear material significance. They're not just ideas. They're ideas which play out in the practice of the law, which involves ultimately the application of force, actually of violence, because the legal system operates through the modern nation state's claim to a monopoly over the use of certain types of force and violence. And that's unavoidable, I think. So whenever we talk about a legal concept like contract, it's in this very material context that these ideas are operationalized, concretized, and actualized by courts, by agents of the state, and also by private parties, who use the power of the state to forward their own ends through contract and property. So law is an interesting space within which to explore the evolution of ideas and studying the evolution of the ideas around status and contract through a genealogy, through a kind of evolutionary approach, which traces these ideas and tries to trace them back to their origin, and then tries to show how ideas changed as the material conditions of society also changed. So the contract status debate is something which goes on against the background of industrialization, and also, of course, things we spent less space in this book discussing, but have discussed elsewhere, like imperialism and colonization. These ideas co-evolved with material changes in society. So part of the analysis that we put forward was the claim that social law has very old origins. And if I had had more time, or had thought about the book a bit differently 20-odd years ago, I might have spent more time talking about the French Revolution, but the focus was on the British Industrial Revolution. But the idea that law is used to manage risk, and in particular to provide protection against labour market risk, economic insecurity, social insecurity, and thereby has a kind of capability building function, because without mechanisms of insurance, social insurance, without the wage, which is more than the price for labour, it's a way of smoothing income over time and creating insurance type effects. Without these legal mechanisms, participation in a labour market where workers are excluded from the means of production and must sell their labour capacity to survive isn't possible. Right at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution in England, there already is a poor law, which is a forerunner of social security law. And already in the early 17th century, there's discussion of the notion of risk, or as it was called, mischance, in Michael Dalton's textbook of the poor law. And it's legally significant because books about the poor law, which is a forerunner to social security law, were some of the first legal treatises ever written in England. There were other books, Cook on Littleton, books about Roman law, books about property law, but many of the first textbooks that people actually used, justices of the peace, were about the poor law. And the poor were not just those who were destitute. The poor were those who labour to live. So the poor were the working class, or those who had to sell their labour to survive. Dalton says, those who labour to live. This is 1618 already, before we have really an industrial revolution on the modern scale. And he says that poverty in this sense, economic insecurity, is not caused by riot, expense, or carelessness, but by mischance. So already there's an echo of contemporary debates about whether poverty is the fault of the poor, or whether the unemployed are unemployed through their own fault. These are not new issues. In 1793, Louis-Antoine de Saint-Just, whom history knows as the archangel of terror in the French Revolution, perhaps a much misunderstood figure, also a philosopher and a brilliant administrator, Saint-Just wrote, "There should be neither rich nor poor." So already again, in the French Revolution, the notion of social rights is there right from the beginning, although this is swiftly covered over in the 1790s after the defeat of the Jacobins. We didn't hear much about it for a long time. Even in 1848, when people used the expression right to work, it was a comparative novelty. But of course, over time, the civil and political rights established by the French Revolution are joined with social rights. Part of this process, I think, of labour law creating a labour market involves shifting the structure of industry itself. So when there are labour regulations in a capitalist economy, firms compete in a certain way. They compete differently from a world in which there are no labour protections. And almost the first example of this that's discussed in any detail is Marx's account of the factory system in chapter 15, volume 1 of Capital, where Marx discusses the argument of the political economists of the day that imposing protections in the form of a shorter working week would put firms out of business and dilute their profits. And he says, well, actually, it probably will, but the firms which are put out of business are the outmoded, underdeveloped, undercapitalized, and inefficient firms. Well, he doesn't say that, but he says these are the firms which are going out of business gradually. And the Factory Acts, he says, move on artificially help this industrial revolution, which takes place spontaneously. Marx is almost certainly the first person to use this expression, industrial revolution. People say Toynbee did, but he wrote later. So I suspect Marx wrote this first, although in German. Whether Toynbee, he must have read a German version of Capital. But Marx is talking here about the effect of the factory acts. They purge capital of inefficiencies. Now, of course, we now know, thanks to the research by Catherine Moose and other people, that after the factory acts were introduced, and collective bargaining also became established in many industries, the profitability of the factory sector actually improved, if that's the right way to put it, and so did productivity, and working hours were also reduced. So the origin of modern working time law, the origin of the International Labour Organization Convention No. 1 on the working day, the 8-hour day, and what became eventually the 40-hour week, initially 48 hours. These go back to the English, British Factory Acts, and became a global model. Although, as we explain in the law of the labour market, the Factory Acts did not survive for various reasons. They became outmoded and were overtaken by collective bargaining. That's also part of the story, actually, that the Factory Acts were confined to dealing with the conditions of adult women and children and never regulated the hours of adult men. And already the problem with the Factory Acts, despite their success actually in establishing some kind of labour capital compromise, the problem was that because they did not regulate the hours of adult males, they set a lower standard for women workers. And this was never really rectified by collective bargaining. So there was already a kind of fragmentation on the supply side because of the way the Factory Acts worked. The second example I want to briefly discuss of the same effect concerns the Fabian critique of the poor law that was mounted by Sidney and Beatrice Webb and William Beveridge and others at the end of the 19th century and the start of the 20th. So this is more social security. What replaced the poor law was social insurance. And the critique of the poor law at the end of the 19th century mounted by the Webbs and the Fabians was an extremely practical one. It didn't work. Now, we can argue all day about whether labour law is about protecting workers or making capitalism work, but maybe it does both. And in this case, the argument mounted by the opponents of the poor law was that it was cruel, it was degrading, it did produce. The critique they made of the poor law was that it was extremely cruel. I mean, it was degrading. It was coercive. And it didn't work either, right? So what they said was the poor law, following the principle of less eligibility, must always be worse than the worst conditions for the so-called independent labourer in the labour market. But actually, the poor law pulled standards down, so it became counterproductive. And no matter how far they tried, they had test workhouses and other institutions at the end of the 19th century, they couldn't make them degrading enough. Eventually, thought began to turn around on this, and they said, well, actually, this is a futile process. What the Webb said was needed was decasualization of the labour market, investment in training, labour exchanges, and also social insurance, which pooled risk. And this eventually led to the National Insurance Act, critique of the poor law, in many ways owed much to the original Marxian critique of capitalism. Of course, the Fabians are said to be gradualists and institutionalists, but maybe they've also been misunderstood by history just as much as Saint-Just was. The solution they came up with, of course, borrowed from mainland European precedents, particularly German ones, in building a social insurance system. But this social insurance system made it possible for risk to be diffused across the whole labour force. Eventually, middle-class earners were brought within the system. So whereas private insurance cherry-picked the low-risk workers, social insurance diffused it more generally to a working class that then benefited from it. Beveridge argued that unemployment was not caused by laziness or fecklessness, but by industry itself. So capitalism caused unemployment, and there were institutional solutions available, which eventually led to Beveridge's tract, Full Employment in a Free Society, in 1945, and to a macroeconomic policy which stabilised labour demand. Right. The third example I have relates to the continuing debate over the minimum wage in Britain, which is a more recent debate. In 1981, my colleague and former supervisor, Frank Wilkinson, and co-author, published with Christine Craigiel, Rubri, and Roger Tarling, an analysis of the British Wages Council system. The title of this book is Labour Market Structure, Industrial Organisation, and Low Pay. And the title expresses the connection that low pay is a function of industrial disorganisation, and labour market structure follows from that. And what the Cambridge School argued at that point was necessary was a comprehensive, legally binding minimum wage for the UK, which there had never been. There had been partial regulation through the Wages Council system, and that was a conscious choice, which was justified by Otto Kornfreund and others as collective laissez-faire, you know, leaving collective bargaining alone as far as possible and regulating at the margins. The problem with that was the same problem as had previously applied to the Factory Acts. Not having a single labour code covering everybody with at least basic protection fragments labour supply, and I might argue also fragments worker solidarity. It also enables undercapitalised and not very well-run firms to survive in the under-regulated sectors. That was the nature of the Cambridge critique. So that was advanced as an argument for a comprehensive labour code, which would embed labour standards across the whole labour market, so there wouldn't be these exceptions. And it's in a direct line from the argument that Webbs had made, but also the one Marx had made about the Factory Acts in the middle of the 19th century. That argument flowed into a debate which began in the late 1980s around the minimum wage. At the start of my academic career, I was working with Frank and part of, or enabled to participate in, discussions with trade union leaders and MPs in Westminster about proposals for a minimum wage reform, which then were written up in a document published by the Low Pay Forum, which brought together people like Rodney Bickerstaff and Frank and other academics and the Low Pay Unit and other trade unionists. And this document called Britain Can't Afford Low Pay was a kind of green paper that we wrote for a minimum wage reform that would have argued for a comprehensive legal floor and on top of that, sector level collective bargaining and other reforms as well. This document is so obscure, I'd actually lost my copy, that when I came to research this recently for a paper I wrote, I was able eventually only to find a copy on eBay, but I was able to buy one. It was a copy which had been discontinued from UMIST Library. Right, okay, so this is such an obscure document, but a really important one, I think, because what it laid out was a proposal for a minimum wage reform that the Labour Party never adopted. It was considered around the time of the 1992 general election, but when Labour didn't win that election, it was dropped. And what happened in 1998 was a much more minor measure. Important, of course, okay, that the minimum wage is an important measure, but omitting sectoral collective bargaining and also an automatic uprating mechanism, which we have proposed along French lines, that may have helped condemn it in the eyes of some people, unfortunately. So if I'd come up with a British president, it might have worked better. But nobody really wanted to borrow the French smic at that point. So the minimum wage was an important measure. 1998 Act was very significant, but a much more ambitious measure had been proposed. Today, the minimum wage has been raised to a level which approximates the French level, and that's occurred over time without the law requiring it. What we don't have is a weekly guaranteed wage or a monthly guaranteed wage of the French kind, and that's fed into the debate we now have about 0 hours contracts and casualisation, I think. The absence of that mainland European mechanism for wage stability has been a big problem. And we also have a huge tax credit system. Subsidising low pay is really a way to subsidise low-paying firms and builds in really quite severe distortions or inefficiencies to the way the labour market works, and thereby denies opportunities for both firms and workers. It's a capability denying move, I think. So summing up, what's happened to British labour market policy, not just since we wrote our book, but really even before that, it's since the whole of my academic life, it's been a series of catastrophic mistakes and wrong turns, in my opinion. And that's why in Britain we have stagnating wages, stagnating productivity. We have a very large number of low-paid workers and a very high rate of child poverty and household poverty in this country. And we're reinventing aspects of the poor law, not exactly the workhouse, but we're reinventing cruelty and coercion through the operation of conditionality in the social security system, which all of which was avoidable. Now, it was avoidable by what the Webbs in 1909 called practicable measures or administrative measures, which could have been put in place to avoid this, and which other countries tend to take for granted about the way their labour markets and labour law institutions work. And that's the context in which we can now have a debate about the Employment Rights Bill. The first thing to say about this bill, I think, is that it is very different in many respects from the New Labour legislation of the late 1990s. On the face of it, it doesn't seem to be all that important. It's a very complicated bill, which in a way misses lots of opportunities to do things. The government has said it's just the first step towards, as they put it, making work pay. However, they have in the flanking documents and support documents, including the impact assessments, which were written by the DBT economists, largely accepted the argument that labour standards can have beneficial social and economic impacts, can be positive for productivity and also for employment. And that argument, which Frank made going back to the 1970s, which informed the work of the Institute of Employment Rights, trade union think tank, and fed into the Institute's manifesto for labour law, and that in turn fed into Making Work Pay, even though Making Work Pay and the Employment Rights Bill are very, very, fall very, very far short of the ambition of the IER manifesto. A lot of the thinking is still there. This is absolutely not what happened in 1997, 1998, when a similar document published by the Institute of Employment Rights called Working Life was rejected by the then Labour shadow employment spokesman David Blunkett on the very same day it was published, I think. It was quite extraordinary. So this time that rejection hasn't happened. So there appears to be a more open mind on these issues. And what's changed in the meantime, I think, is that doing something about inequality and poverty is seen as an urgent matter. It wasn't seen as that urgent, I think, in 1997. Most Labour Party politicians and civil servants probably thought the basic model is fine, we don't need to tinker with it. This is before the rise of populism and an authoritarian threat to social democracy, which we now face that they didn't face. So I think there's a greater urgency about labour law now than there used to be. There's still, of course, a debate about means and ends. Right? You still meet plenty of people, social scientists of all disciplines, not just neoclassical economists, will be sceptical about the prospects for using labour law to undergird economic reform. That debate continues, and it's quite right that it should do. But I think there has been something of a shift of sentiment in the UK in the meantime, and there's never been a better opportunity now to make the argument which we sort of made in 2005, which is certainly for using the capability approach, but also for a comprehensive labour code and maybe a labour market code. So the difference, the divergence between social security law and labour law is a fundamental problem, I think. Lack of fit between them is a real problem. And that lack of fit wasn't there in the Beveridgian or Webbian conception, because it was very clear that the unemployed had every right to refuse work below labour standards, work below the going rate in a collective agreement. You could always refuse to do that. Conditionality rules enabled the unemployed to wait for a job in their profession or trade, which they cannot now do. Social assistance was not just more generous, but was a backup that genuinely worked and wasn't attached to conditionality in the same way as it now is. So that delinking of labour and social security law begins with the neoliberal push in the 1980s of the Thatcher governments, and the new Labour governments accepted it as well. They expanded the tax credit scheme inherited from the Conservative administration. The fundamental turning point being the Social Security Act 1986, which ushered that in. So now I think Labour lawyers should make the argument for a comprehensive Labour code all over again. And of course, there are things in law of the labour market which were rightly criticised by Ruth and others, maybe some infelicitous phrasing, and maybe some ideas that should have been challenged about exactly what labour law does in relation to capitalism. It is, of course, true, as she says, that the book was written at a certain time, and you can't really avoid writing a book like this, other influences. When the book was published in 2005, unfortunately, these things happen. I think it was a little bit out of time because we've been planning it for a long time. And sometimes academic projects take longer to come to fruition than they should do. That's just academic life. We had originally planned the book, I think, for a time when it might have had a greater impact. Although, looking back, we know it wouldn't have done. Had the book appeared 10 years earlier, it still would not have influenced New Labour. I think that's absolutely clear. As it is, the book was written for a long view. You know, we consciously wrote a book that was historical, hoping that it would last as a piece of work, and it would last beyond the point at which it was published, when really there wasn't much interest in this theme. New Labour was coming to the end of its time, running out of energy, and the European Union was moving away from even the Supio report that we discussed towards flexicurity, which was a backward step for the EU. But because the book was written in a certain way, not exactly to be timeless, but we were attempting something like that, it's had a long history. And it's had a long history largely thanks to the people like Ruth and others who've engaged with it. I was looking the other day at some citation data, and the citations go down before about 2014, and they go up afterwards. Okay, so I think this is what, of course, one would want from a book, that that people engage with it. And I think I'd just like to say how grateful I am to all those, Ruth, Emilios, and others who are online today for engaging with these ideas. You know, I think it's really important. However, I would defend what's written in the book. Although I think that I'd write it differently now, there might be more Marx and there might be more Louis-Antoine de Saint-Just. Okay, I think the arguments are still valid and still there to be debated. Thank you.
Brilliant. Thank you. Excellent. I think what we do is we'll now go straight to you, Ruth, actually, unless people have got clarifying questions, and then we can do the Q&A afterwards.
So thank you for the invitation to be here today. Thank you also to Simon. I really enjoyed reading the draft paper that he sent round in advance of this and listening to him just now. So, yes, I'll crack on. Over the past 20 years or so, Amartya Sen's ideas of capabilities has been drawn upon by several scholars of labour law, including prominently Alain Supiot in France and Brian Langille in Canada, as well as Simon Deacon and Frank Wilkinson. In a book published in 2014 called The Labour Constitution, I considered Deacon and Wilkinson's work on capabilities as offering an analysis and theoretical underpinning of some of the third wave policies and legal innovations of the new Labour government under Tony Blair. I identified what appeared to me to be some potential shortcomings of Deacon and Wilkinson's theory along the lines that Simon mentions in the written version of his paper. My central concern was that the move to characterise social rights contra T.H. Marshall as guaranteeing the effective conditions for the functioning of labour markets could tend to obscure rather than transcend conflicts of interest between workers and employers. So my point was not that social rights or labour rights must always act in tension with the market or must always serve to limit market freedoms. They might or they might not. My argument was rather that whether social rights help to make markets function better or not, they might be resisted by employers, by firms concerned with profits or with the return to shareholders in the short term, rather than with what is good for the economy as a whole, and having any other options to choose from, including exit. In short, I argued that when it came to debates over law reform, The claim that labour rights are desirable because they help labour markets to function better might simply be rejected by capital, especially if it was being asked to bear the immediate costs of the rights in question. And indeed, we're seeing that now with the Employment Rights Bill. While Deakin and Wilkinson's theory certainly recognised the existence of conflicts of interest in employment relations, it risked, on my reading, downplaying the fundamental importance of strong trade unions with widely drawn rights to freedom of association. I should say immediately that Simon has been quite right to suggest that I read Chapter 5 somewhat apart from the rest of the book. And I would also like to emphasise at the outset that, notwithstanding the criticisms I've just sketched, I found the work then and still today to be highly sophisticated, extremely rich, and largely very persuasive. More generally, I'm a huge admirer of Simon's scholarship, and I think that any point of disagreement I might have with him could only ever really be quite minor in the grand scheme of things. Of course, sometimes it can be helpful to emphasise points of disagreement in the interests of stimulating debate or developing an argument. So what I'd like to do this afternoon is to come at capabilities rather gradually through a discussion of the scholarship of Otto Kahn-Freund, Simon's already mentioned. For those of you unfamiliar with that name, let me first say that very briefly that he was a foundational scholar of labour law who, because of the times he lived in, had two quite distinct careers. One could almost say a life of two halves. Born in Germany in 1900, he worked in Berlin as a labour court judge and author in the 1920s and early 30s. Having fled to the UK as a refugee from Nazism in 1933, he became eventually a prominent legal scholar in this country, professor at the LSE and then Oxford, editor of the Modern Law Review and fellow of the British Academy. Importantly for our purposes, Kahn-Freund was centrally concerned in his work throughout his life with developing a normative as well as an analytical account of labour law. Whether he was pointing to weaknesses in the existing law, arguing for law reform or defending the status quo, he always provided an account of what he thought the law should be doing. Especially when considering Deakin and Wilkinson's capabilities theory as a neo-Fabian agenda for labour market reform, as they put it in the conclusion to Chapter 5, I think it can be helpful to provide both some historical context, as Simon's indeed already done, and an outline of one or two alternative visions of how best to understand and analyse labour law. And we can do both of these things by comparing two rather different chapters in the life's work of Kahn-Freund, namely his critique of labour law and especially judicial decision-making in the Weimar Republic, and his post-war theory of English labour law, which he encapsulates two chapters from Kahn-Freund's work, the first, his critique of labour law in the Weimar Republic, and the second, his theory of English labour law, which he encapsulated in the principle of collective laissez-faire. So in 1931 and 1932, Kahn-Freund published a short monograph and an article which appeared in English translation eventually as The Social Ideal of the Reich Labour Court and the Changing Function of Labour Law. In The Social Ideal, Kahn-Freund analysed the decisions of the National Labour Court over the course of the 1920s. Through that analysis, he demonstrated that the social ideal, or body of social and economic ideas, which underlay judicial practice had been a fascist one. Fascist was used here in the Italian sense, meaning in essence that the judges had favoured a form of corporatism in which the state was in control and the autonomy of the trade unions and employers' associations was severely restricted. The new labour law of the Weimar Republic had been intended, Kahn-Freund wrote, as an instrument to assist the rise of the suppressed class. In the hands of the court, it had been transformed into an instrument of the state to suppress class contradictions. What the judges ought to have done, he argued, was to treat the socioeconomic conflict between workers and their employers as a given fact. The conflict which governed the relations between those parties ought to have been left for the most part to the parties themselves to resolve. The judiciary ought to have limited its role to the cautious application of existing norms, intervening only when the law made it absolutely necessary. In the changing function of labour law, Cantwright developed this same theme using the key analytical concept of collectivism, which he defined as follows. The socio-political system of collectivism is characterized by a particular attitude of the state towards the class struggle. The legal system does not negate the class struggle or suppress it, but it does not allow it unlimited freedom. It rather attempts, within the framework of the capitalist system, to determine the way it is conducted by the establishment of legal norms, and over and above this, to utilise the results of each individual stage of conflict for the further development of the law. Looking back at this work today, it's striking both for its sophisticated socio-legal method and for its expression of socialist conviction. In both respects, the influence of the Austrian socio-legal scholars Karl Renner and Eugen Ehrlich is clear, and also, of course, that of Karl Marx, especially in the fundamental importance accorded to class conflict as both a structural feature of industrial relations and an engine for social progress. From our perspective, it's particularly interesting to note the emphasis that was placed by Cantwright and other labour law scholars of the time on the value of freedom. Labour law was understood, as we've just seen, as an instrument to assist the rise of the suppressed class. It aimed to emancipate workers, rendering them free from subordination to capital and free to participate in the determination of wages and other terms and conditions of employment. Freedom was the key aim, and labour law was constructed on the understanding that in capitalist society, substantive, as opposed to merely formal, freedom could only be achieved and exercised through the collective. Individual freedom could only be achieved and exercised through the collective. In work written in England in the 1950s, Cantwright again applied a socio-legal method to the study of labour law. In doing so, however, he developed a rather different account of what he thought the role of law should be. Famously, he emphasised with approbation the extent to which industrial relations in the UK were practised beyond the reaches of the law. Collective agreements were not understood in English law, as they were in other jurisdictions, to be legally binding contracts, the rationale being that the parties to the collective agreements lacked contractual intent. So it was possible for the normative parts of collective agreements, so those dealing with wages and terms and conditions, to be made legally binding through incorporation into individual contracts of employment. The matter of incorporation was consensual as between the contractual parties and non-compulsory. Reviewing the provisions of labour law beyond this specific question of the legal effect of collective agreements, Cantwright concluded that there was something quite particular about the law in the UK when viewed in comparative perspective. In the case of minimum wage laws, of conciliation and arbitration, of trade union recognition, and so on, careful analysis revealed that in every case, and this is a quote, the law recognises the desirability of collective bargaining, but it refuses to apply legal sanctions so as to enforce it. This was the essence of Cantwright's principle or theory of collective laissez-faire. Labour law in the UK was first and foremost procedural law. It facilitated and supported the collectivisation of labour, and it prescribed the Queensbury rules that would ensure some measure of order and decency in collectivised labour's clashes with management. Comparison of the socio-legal analysis of Weimar law in the early 30s and that of UK law in the 50s and 60s reveals important differences, most strikingly a move away from the language of class conflict and the positing instead of conflicts of interest between labour and management, and an emphasis on the desirability of balancing the power of the two sides. Note too that the extent of the conflicts of interest between the two sides of industry is circumscribed somewhat narrowly in the later work with reference to wages and other terms and conditions of employment. On that basis, engagement and collective bargaining is argued to be in the interests of both sides. Quote, one interest which management and labour have in common is that conflicts over wages and terms and conditions should be regulated from time to time by reasonably predictable procedures. The primary role of labour law for this confluent of the post-war decades was not to facilitate the gradual transformation of the economy and society and the emancipation of the working class from its subordination to capital. Much more modestly, labour law was to facilitate and support, although I should say there was still a very big emphasis placed on freedom and on the idea of freeing the worker. So that's maybe I should have put that a different way. Much more modestly, labour law was to facilitate and to support the collectivisation of labour and the establishment of procedures allowing for give and take on both sides. So back to Deakin and Wilkinson. Like any theory, Deakin and Wilkinson's ideas concerning capabilities and social rights must be understood with reference to the time and place in which they were developed. By the beginning of this century, trade union membership and the coverage of collective agreements had fallen in the UK to less than half of what they'd been in the 1970s. Neoliberal thinking had become so dominant that it had acquired the status of a new common sense. In light of these and other changes, it had become more or less indisputable that old ideas of labour law, including collective laissez-faire, had become outdated, at least in some respects. I've got now a fairly lengthy quote from Lord Wedderburn, writing in 1989, which was on one of my slides, but I'll just read it out. So, there is now a challenge to those who do not accept neoliberal orthodoxies on law and the labour market, who continue to assert the value of free and effective association, affirming both the need for collective combination as a condition of freedom for employed individuals, and the right to organise together in protection of their occupational interests and against exploitation in a pluralist democracy. If they hold that the concept of social justice is not wholly meaningless, they will also refuse to accept that the limitations on human knowledge, real though they undoubtedly are, preclude all possibility of managing a free society in the general interest. Yet, thrown into confusion by the newly dominant philosophy, they have found that their old arguments will not do. I've always understood Deakin and Wilkinson's capabilities theory as a response to precisely this challenge, an attempt to find new arguments to support old values. What was needed, as they put it, was an agenda for labour law reform that would seek to recreate, under modern conditions, the institutional basis for reconciling individual freedom with the market order. While the theory that they developed was naturally quite different to collective laissez-faire in significant respects, it also shared some important continuities. Above all, perhaps, in its ambition to function as a framework that would allow for both detailed legal analysis of the law in force or of proposals for law reform and normative critique. Like collective laissez-faire, it recognised the existence of conflicts of interest between managers and workers, but circumscribed these quite narrowly as concerning essentially the distribution of profits. This narrow circumscription of conflict allowed for the positive, at least in Chapter 5, I should say, this narrow circumscription of conflict allowed for the positing of a pretty wide scope for common interests, and in particular for the development of the argument that social rights could benefit management and the workforce alike. Social rights created a balance of power in the workplace, in organisations, in the wider society, as they put it, which in turn improved the creation, development and use of productive resources and prevented their dissipation in unemployment and poverty. Turning back for a moment to consider the time and place of writing of Confluent's theory of collective laissez-faire, we would have to emphasise that it's now widely recognised that the post-war decades were exceptional in many respects. As Richard Hyman has put it, the heyday of collective laissez-faire reflected a material context which was both geographically bounded and historically exceptional. Geographically bounded because limited to a relatively small number of rich democracies, and historically exceptional in terms of the extent of economic stability and expansion that was enjoyed at this time of post-war reconstruction, Keynesian economic policies, including the nationalisation of large parts of industry and the Bretton Woods Agreement. All of this facilitated positive sum collective bargaining and the acquiescence of capital to a system that involved elements of power and profit sharing. Not only in labour law, but right across the social sciences, the post-war decades were a period when scholars tended to base their analyses on the unspoken presumption that capital had been tamed once and for all, turned into a kind of public utility for the benefit of society as a whole, a neutral apparatus for the joint production of shared prosperity. Class conflict appeared, accordingly, to narrow or to recede, and was replaced in the conception of scholars by conflict between management and labour, the two sides of industry. As the political economist Wolfgang Streeck has put it, however, by the end of the 1970s at the latest, capitalism had become determined to break out of the social democratic stable into which it had been pressed, being no longer willing and able to make do with the sensible but small servings of profit allowed by the political masters. Against all expectations, capitalism in the 1980s and 90s recaptured its dynamic and once again became an unwieldy, stochastic source of unplanned social and institutional change. We're now living in an age where, as Canfranc once said of the Weimar Republic, the conflictual element is more palpable, more visible to the eye than it was in the post-war decades. Conflicts of interest and massive inequalities of wealth between different sections of society are obvious, explicit, and common ground is more difficult to identify. That capitalism must be brought back into the analysis is widely recognised across the social sciences. And this helps to explain too, I think, why, which is not to infer that it's not there in Deakin and Wilkinson's book, but it does help to explain too, I think, why scholars of labour law are turning increasingly to approaches which centre class conflict and politics. It's always been a real strength of labour law scholarship that it's open to learning from other disciplines. And especially among younger labour law scholars, we see today a renewed interest in Weimar scholarship, in the Italian workerists, and even in the Soviet legal theorist Evgeny Pashukhanis. We see a new interest, as Simon mentioned, in the legacies of imperialism and colonialism, and a renewed emphasis of the fundamental importance of trade unions and freedom of association to any system of labour law that aims to secure individual freedom to workers. A renewed conviction that in the sphere of work relations, individual freedom can only be achieved collectively.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Really appreciated quite a lot to chew through on this. Simon, I think it's only fair if I give you a brief chance to respond before we then go for questions. But if people have got any questions, do raise your hands. I'll try and then gather them up. And also feel free to put questions in the chat as well. But over to you, Simon, I think, for a brief response to what Ruth said.
No, I'm very happy to go to the questions, Tom.
Okay.
I just want to say... I don't think Ruth and I disagree about a lot today. Maybe we would have, the disagreement might have been sharper a decade ago. But again, the context moves on, and I accept much of the original critique Ruth made, and some of the points she's just made I wouldn't disagree with. Maybe she agrees with me on some matters relating to competition and discovery. I see that in her book with Wolfgang, she discusses Hayek a little bit. So I think I'd have a more more profound disagreement with colleagues who would argue that putting in place labour laws which by one means or another produce greater equality or stability might have the effect of supporting a capitalist system which might be on its last legs. I think that there really is a stronger disagreement there, but that's perhaps a slightly different issue.
Yeah. Could I prompt while people are thinking then, could I pose a question on this? And this is one on particular aspect of it. But you talked in your talk, Simon, about the lack of fit between social security and labour law. And I mean, there's a broader context to this, but in the UK context, from my perspective, how do you resolve that lack of fit? Because we have obviously, I'm just speaking on the UK, you talk very positively about the Employment Rights Bill. But we do also at the same time, you know, the government has an 80% employment target. It has a social security system, which they're broadly not going to touch. Or, I mean, the debate there is on exactly that. And we saw that in today's news, actually, and for British people. And I'm sure this plays out in other countries. So how, I guess it's a question to you first, Simon, but then to Ruth, because it kind of gets to the heart of this. How do you resolve that lack of fit in the system we currently have?
So, as I said briefly in the presentation, that there was a better fit between approximately the 1910s and the 1980s, because just as much as labour law, largely through collective bargaining, put in place a series of national and sectoral standards which bound all employers, there was not just self-enforcement through industrial action, but also arbitration, slightly technical, Order 1305, and then later the Employment Protection Act 1975 had similar mechanisms to mainland European sectoral bargaining extension laws and collective arbitration, tremendously useful, and that can be brought back now, I think.
Yeah.
Strong case for that. On the social security side, it fitted precisely because of the work conditionality rules, enabling the labour supply to be controlled and regulated with labour standard enforcement in mind. That fit can easily be re-established, and it's been allowed to wither away since about 1980. The first paper Frank and I wrote for the Institute of Employment Rights in 1989, it was published in the Cambridge Journal of Economics as well, it was about social security and labour law and how they fitted together, and it was also about inequality. And maybe that didn't receive quite the right emphasis in the book, but it's perfectly possible to fit them back together. But I agree with you, that discussion with the current government is going to be extremely difficult, because I think although they may have accepted the case for labour law reform, they don't appear yet to have accepted the case for social security reform.
Yeah. Yeah. And Ruth, do you have any comments on that?
Yes. Yes. So on the Employment Rights Bill, one of the aims is to reduce or to address precarious employment, and various steps are being taken towards that. One which isn't in the bill, but which is part of the bigger plan, is to eventually work towards a single status so that you don't have this the different categories of employees and workers and so on. But at the same time as the government is amending labour law with the aim of getting rid or trying to address precarious employment, it has increased the national insurance contributions of employers for employees, which provides them with an even greater impetus to try and take their workers outside of the category of employees. So that's just another way, another illustration of the lack of fit that Simon's talking about.
Yeah, and Orchard, sorry, Peter, you were first. Do you want to ask?
Right. I have actually two questions. First one also relates to this issue of the fit between labor law and social security law. I think that's a very important point, and I agree completely that both have to be considered at the same time, and the issue of how they're related is a major issue in shaping and regulating labor markets. But I'm not quite sure, I'm not familiar with the English system of tax credits, but I think the idea to reestablish this fit by universalizing in a way social insurance, it doesn't convince me completely, because first of all, there is a segment of precarious labor and non-standard employment relations, and for people in those sectors, it is impossible to achieve a sufficient amount of insurance eligibility. So you have to have another system of social security besides the insurance system. So this idea of reestablishing the fit by just banking on social insurance, that's my is that realistic? That's my first question. And the second question is actually on how the labor law fits into an idea of creating capabilities for workers. There is this reference to capability, but I'm more interested in the kind of and the mechanisms you consider important, how labor law can create individual capabilities, and how this is related to the idea of collective defense of workers' interests. You only made one point, as far as I was able to follow. That was that you consider labor law as a conversion factor, but maybe you can say some. You can say some more about that.
If you want to comment, Simon. Yep. You're on mute.
No, thank you very much, Peter.
No,
is that okay?
We can hear you. Yeah, brilliant.
Yeah. So maybe I should say more about capabilities, because I didn't say enough in the talk. Of course, as part of the projects which Peter and I actually worked together on, the CapRight project, and before that the Eurocap project, these were projects which the European Union FP6 and FP5 programs, an earlier version of the Horizon programs, I suppose, funded from the late 1990s for about a decade or so. And the impetus came from the Supio report and from Rob Saleh's chapter in that report, which wrote about capacities, capabilities. And I understood that the Supio report may initially have been written without really thinking about capability theory at all. And Robert joined the group, I think, towards the end of the drafting process, I think, when they needed an input from an economist. And they'd only really been able to get very neoclassical economists commenting. So there was a collective effort, I thought, at the time, to think about capability theory, and to think about it really hard, and to think about what it meant for law and how it would work. And other people in that group, Jean-Michel Bonvin, as a colleague, wrote about this. I did, Frank did. The idea that we find in Sen of conversion factors, which could be physical, could be material, but also institutional, was one we thought was helpful. And we tried to distinguish between functionings and capabilities, thinking of capabilities as a potential and not just as an actuality, which a functioning might be. I realized we could get into a technical discussion about this, but this seemed to me to be very helpful. And Frank had also written an earlier paper, I'm not sure it ever got published, about commodities and capabilities, arguing about Sen and Lancaster and some of the 1960s Cambridge School thought about that. So there have been these earlier links to a body of thought, which in some ways even predates Sen himself, although Sen, clearly having been in Cambridge at the time, was influenced by this debate, I'm sure. Not exactly confident about Sen's own intellectual biography, but certainly our writings on capability theory were informed by the debate around the Supio report and the very practical issue of working in a group which was devoted to thinking about capabilities. That's what we were doing. And I still find it a useful framework, but I was taken aback, in a sense, when later on the debate amongst my fellow labour lawyers about capability theory seemed to go off on a completely different tangent. And that was because other people were writing about it and didn't come out of this way of thinking, I thought. And maybe some of that debate was really a debate about we must move away from the protective function of labour law. Now, that wasn't, I think, what Supio or Saleh had in mind. I'm absolutely sure it wasn't what Saleh or Supio had in mind, and nor were we thinking that we should move away from protection. But my thought was that many of the things which labour law does can be thought of as, this may seem very abstract, but converting a commodity into a capability is in a sense what labour law does. It creates a commodity labour power, and it commodifies labour capacity. So does collective bargaining, and so does social security. They provide the basis for social reproduction. And Marshall himself, T.H. Marshall, said collective bargaining was a normal market operation. So I never understood again exactly why this argument about Marshall is being made against us. We do discuss Marshall at quite some length in the book as well. But the idea that capability theory leaves the commodity function untouched, or that Sen himself wasn't interested or concerned with Marx, he absolutely was. And Ingrid Robins argued, didn't she, at length, that there were Marxian elements to Sen's thought. So the argument amongst labour lawyers that this marked some kind of move away from Marxist thought or a radical conception of how the labour market might work was one I struggled with and still do. I didn't recognise my own work in some of the critiques made of it. But I think that's just part of this process.
Yeah. Excellent. Ruth, do you have any comments on this? No, it's perfect. So, Ortrud, I think we've got you first and then Charisse, if you want to ask your question.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much for these talks. I'm a bit sorry because I have worked on the issue of employment some time ago, and now I feel like I'm not so much involved in all of this, but I still would like to know a bit more on how this all so how you see this the relation to German lawyers or law in Germany, because in Germany, I'm an economist by training, but I worked with someone from social security law social protection law, and it was really a divide between her and another colleague from labor law. So I think in Germany we have this, if you bring both together, it's like you have to work interdisciplinary, and within labor law in Germany, as far as I can see, there are also these two sides of labor law, the ones who are more interested in the rights of the employees and the others who are more on the employer side. So I would just like to know a little bit how you see this, whether this is very a very particular situation in Germany because I think the system of law is really very different in UK and from continental Europe. So it's just curiosity. Thanks very much.
Ruth, do you want to start with that maybe, actually? Because given that you're maybe to flip it around, if you've got any comments.
Terribly sorry, but I missed, I think, an important bit because my internet connection is suddenly unstable. So when Ortrud was talking about some kind of conflict between the social security lawyer and the labour lawyer, then I missed the next bit.
I just think that in Germany, between the the lawyers from social security and labor law, there's a divide, and then there is also within the labor law, between labor lawyers, there are those two parties, the ones who are more on the side of the employees and the others who are on the employer side. And I wonder whether this is particularly for German, a particular German problem, or whether you can find it in other countries as well.
Well, most labor law scholars in the UK are on the left, I would say, which is different to Germany. But on the social security, the divide between social security and employment law, also within universities, has been really problematic. So it is unusual that someone is expert in both social security and labour law. And, you know, one of the great strengths of Simon and Deacon and Wilkinson's proposed labour market, law of the labour market, is that it says, you know, it's really wrong to study these two things in isolation. It doesn't make sense. And they show through their historical analysis why it's really important to look at the two together. But being able to look at the two together, you know, means being able to master two bodies of law, and social security law is always incredibly complex. So there's few people that manage it in this country as well as in Germany, perhaps.
Did you have any comments, Simon?
Yes, just very briefly. I've never had the chance to even teach social security law. It's actually difficult to put a course on. It is very technical. Of course, it must be taught in a way that links it to political economy and labour law. When I first wrote on social security law in a more doctrinal way and contributed to a social security law textbook, I was researching areas of law like national insurance contributions, actually. I had the distinct impression there might be one other person in the whole world who knew anything about this. You know, it's really very technical and marginal. But it's extremely important, and I think it's studied more seriously in other countries, and not just by technical experts, but by even school students who understand the nature of public finance. Yeah, I remember a Portuguese colleague explaining this to me, that we don't even explain to our own fellow citizens how the National Insurance Fund works, and in fact many of our politicians misunderstand it, in my view. But that's just the nature of the subject. It's very technical. I think in Germany there are many colleagues, Ulrich Muckenberger, others who did bridge this gap, so that there are labour law colleagues who also knew about social security law. And the same would be true of the French debate, of course. Droit social, this is a social law category, which spans both disciplines. But it is really difficult, and of course it's difficult to do interdisciplinary research. I was very fortunate when I did my PhD in Cambridge, the Department of Applied Economics was still in existence. And although my thesis was in law, it was possible to get an interdisciplinary training at that point.
Charisse, I think you've got a question. If anyone's got any other questions as well, do raise your hand. I think we've got another 10 minutes or so, just about. So, yeah, but Charisse, over to you.
Thank you both so much for the really stimulating discussion. So I'm just thinking back, Ruth, at the end of your presentation, you said individual freedom can only be achieved collectively. And I think in recent years, we've definitely seen a real appetite among workers for collective voice, demonstrated through the rise in organizing efforts and industrial action and whatnot. But it doesn't, at least from what I've read, there doesn't seem to be much progress in terms of the amount of workers that do have access to collective voice, meaning like union density rates continue to remain historically low. Perhaps like a slight uptick, but nothing that seems like exciting, I guess you could say. And so I'm just curious to know both Ruth and Simon, like what you sort of think about this sort of phenomenon that we see today, that like workers seem to desire collective voice, but they can't necessarily get it. There is like a pretty major voice gap, which is a term that's coined in the literature that exists. And what like the capability approach could potentially offer to this discussion.
Who wants to start first? You, Simon, I guess.
Well, thank you very much, Charisse. We do discuss in the book that worker militancy is not a continuous phenomenon. It in practice is linked to economic conditions. We can't just rely upon the willingness of workers to take part in strike action, for example, because that's heavily conditional upon factors like high inflation and low unemployment. And they also drive union membership. That's partly why we have law. So the gains which are made in periods of worker militancy are locked in. They were, to a certain extent, locked in the past. We can't expect, I think, worker militancy to operate at the same volume continuously. And nor should we necessarily conclude that there isn't demand for worker voice just because there's a very low level of density. Density is a very noisy variable, isn't it? Membership is very low in France, but we think participation is high because the legal system really nudges people that way. In Italy, we're still told by the OECD there's 100% collective bargaining coverage because of extension laws. Well, it may not quite be 100%, but extension mechanisms in France and Italy, Spain, Germany, and actually most mainland European countries, Eastern European countries too, achieve protection without union membership being necessarily very high. I agree with what Ruth says about the need for worker pressure, worker militancy. That does produce labour law. Again, I remember, we talk about my youth as a researcher. When I was in my 20s, I think, or maybe my 30s, I went to hear a talk by Lord McCarthy, and he was talking about the 1970s, right? Okay, so it was just before my time. But McCarthy said the weather was really good for labour law in the 70s. Inflation was high and strike action was at a near record high. And that's when you get strong labour laws. And I think that was a very important observation.
And did you have comments, Ruth?
Yeah, so, I mean, as Simon's just suggesting at the end there, of course, questions of union membership and so on, what affects it, they're very complicated and there's not just one thing. But it's certainly the case that law is not irrelevant here. I don't think anyone could doubt that. And what we have in this country are some of the most restrictive labour laws in the kind of the global north, probably comparable with the USA in terms of how restrictive they are. So it's one of the disappointments, I think, of the employment rights bill that it hasn't done very much in terms of lessening the restrictions, especially the restrictions on the right to strike, on secondary action and so on, because while law reform would not result overnight in massively increased union membership, it would, I think, over time, definitely make a difference, because it's got to the point in this country where, depending on the kind of union you are, the kind of membership you have, lawful industrial action can be close to impossible in some circumstances, and various other restrictions on freedom of association.
Excellent. I think she's cut off, but we'll go on to Emilios, I think. Did you have a question, Emilios?
Yes, I did.
Apologies, I didn't notice your hand up. Go for it. I think, yeah. Ruth, you cut off just at the last minute then, but we'll go to Emilios. I think we got the gist of what you were saying. Emilios, over to you.
Yeah, apology, exceeding even my usual levels of incompetence. I couldn't find a way of raising my hand.
I know.
This is really fascinating, and thank you very much. And I find myself in agreement with a lot. I was just going to ask something, two questions perhaps, quite short, but centered on capabilities. There's Simon, you started with the social rights and the connection of social rights to capabilities, social rights as enhancing capabilities. And then there was another shift to labour market functioning. Now, a lot of those values that one associated, that you spoke of, in terms of the Supior report and the Saint-Just, etc., had to do with values like solidarity and like equality that don't carry directly, let's say, into market thinking. So there is at least a tension between the kind of social rights and the kind of capabilities that one would want to see incorporated in a functioning labor market. So my first question has to do with that first crossing. Mm. Between the kind of values that we associate with social rights and have to do with a solidarity, etc., and how capabilities realize that. But then the second question I had, and that's perhaps a more one I have a more problem with, is are we talking about humanizing the labor market, or are we talking about optimizing the labor market? Because according to this first line of thinking, you want to humanize it in the sense of carrying in some commitments to solidarity that are not subject to market correction. And I just wonder whether, and I suppose that's my question, do we see, is there at any point in your thinking, do capabilities work as correctives to market allocations? Or is there a sort of seamless alignment between the two? Because if they do serve as correctives to market allocations, what are the criteria of what correctness means in this context? Sorry if that's too big. I just worry about these two crossings. Thank you.
Yes. No. Shall I answer that?
Yeah, please do.
Thank you. Yeah. No. I think this is a thank you, Emilios. I think it's a critical question, which I've thought about a lot when reading your commentary on my work, because I've had the impression that maybe we're working with different conceptions of the market, or with different conceptions of what the market might be. We do need longer to discuss this, but here's a first go. So what I thought of myself with Frank and others as criticizing was a certain understanding of the market, which we might associate with either neoclassical economics or with maybe ordoliberalism, which is a kind of variant, which tends to see, first of all, the market as natural and law or regulation as unnatural. I think the very first sentence in our book, in the preface, makes this point when we say that there's been a tendency to treat the market as primordial or natural. And we're very much against that. And of course, so was Marx. We're very much against natural law, and we're against a new kind of natural law, which is law and economics of the Chicago kind, or now increasingly law and technology, which tries to fold everything into AI. The market is humanly created. The market is a human institution. The textbook market model in neoclassical economics is a severe distortion of reality, which can only work if we assume what it assumes away actually exists, which is lots of law creating not just property rights, but also social rights. A property right is a kind of capability, I think, and many workers value property rights they have to sell their labour capacity. Sen makes this point, doesn't he? And he absolutely talks about freedom of contract and aspirational values being part of the capability approach. That's absolutely correct, and I think you're right to say that Sen's approach to the market, and indeed the whole capability approach, is bound up with the notion of how the market works. However, I don't think the market only has to work in an ordo-liberal or neoliberal or classic early 19th century Smith-Ricardo kind of way. The Fabians certainly had a different conception of the market, but this is something we'd need another seminar, maybe we can have one soon, to discuss. But I think this is an absolutely key point. We probably do disagree on this. Okay, but how do we think about the market? And we think about humanizing it. I would say, well, it's already human. It's already a human creation, a human institution. Of course, markets produce terrible outcomes. Maybe the market produces inequality, poverty, and coercion. It absolutely does, but not all markets do. I think that's my position. And markets, like firms, come in many different forms. But I think I'll stop there because I know we're short of time and there are other people.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Ruth, did you have any comments? No, okay, great. So Nikolai, do you want to quickly get in and ask a question? I think we've got a few more. Well, we actually are on time, but go for it.
Yeah, first of all, thank you for the nice presentation. Just one more or less quick question. You were proposing to view, which makes a lot of sense to me, to view labor law as conversion factors of a specific form. And so, I'm not familiar, so I'm not a law scholar, so I'm not familiar with the details of the discussion there. And I'm wondering how this idea, which also makes sense to me, that of more universal coverage, for example, of labor law, or generalizing to cover all workers, overcome exceptions, and so on, how this exactly squares with, or is discussed with the, in put into context with the idea that Zen in Asia, well, raised initially that when he asked the question, inequality of what? He was arguing that inequality in one space, such as the resource space or entitlements, maybe, actually can translate into different equalities in the capability of functioning space. Or, and if you achieve equality in one space, you might introduce or create inequality in another one. So I wonder to which extent this is maybe explicitly discussed already, that as if it plays the role of a conversion factor. On the one hand, we want to have a general and uniform. On the other hand, it can play a corrective function potentially in order to ultimately kind of, I'm not sure that's the right terms, compensate or address differences in other conversion factors which make for which some subpopulation of people may have more unfortunate conditions to transform resources into capabilities in the end or functionings in the end. So I wonder whether that's explicitly discussed or what's your take on this?
No, thanks so much. That's a really great question. And I think it's a really important issue, which Sam just discussed. That's right. And I think the answer will have to depend upon the model we have of how the labour market works and also how law structures it. So behind the claim that law can be a conversion factor, that behind that is an understanding of law that I would defend again if we had a bit more time as broadly instituting market processes. Possibly law is not completely indispensable for a modern economy, but we rarely see an extensive division of labour and competition in any sort of sense without law being there somewhere. And historically, I would have added more to this in the book if I had been working on it at the time, when the labour market comes into being, there's also the beginning of a kind of legal consciousness. The point about the poor law being an area that people wrote about legally before they wrote about many other things is really interesting. So law is a mechanism of coordination. And back to Emilios's point, it's not the same as the market, absolutely not, and it cannot be reduced to a market logic. And I've argued elsewhere that the market depends on non-market institutions in order to function. That must be correct. This idea, of course, is anathema to a neoclassical economist who wouldn't even think about this. Ordo-liberal economists are more sensitive, I think, to this Victor Vanberg, people like that. But it has to be defended, right? That not everything is the market. Okay, so what Supio calls a total market is a market that doesn't really exist in reality, and or as Polanyi would have argued in The Great Transformation, is so utterly destructive that society can't withstand it. But this is exactly the type of question, Nikolai, I agree, that requires an empirical working out, isn't it? So we need to know what actually happens to inequality if certain institutions are present, what types of equality lead to other inequalities. Is not the equality of formal property and freedom of contract productive of inequality? What kinds of inequality does the welfare state perpetuate unintentionally? I think that's absolutely right.
Excellent. Ruth, do you have any final comments with yourself? Excellent. Okay. Well, we're just a bit over time, actually, so I should probably leave it there. But obviously, I speak for all of us and say thank you so much. I think both of you gave really quite interesting, wide-ranging talks and quite a lot of food for thought on it. And also thanks for the questions for everyone here. So, yeah, I think Nikolai, Peter, we're going to stay on, aren't we, actually, for a bit. But the rest of you, I guess I'll give your evenings back and I'll be in touch as well. But thank you very much.
Thanks so much. Thank you. Thanks.
No worries. Thank you. See you.